Welcome back to another episode of Mazel Tov Cocktail, a Jew-ish left podcast from the land of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation, Melbourne. It's conversations with me, Max Kaiser, and interesting people in Australia and internationally. We've got a great show for you today. With us, we have Leandros Fischer, who is an activist from Germany and a political scientist. And he is going to be talking to us about some thorny issues in the German left today. So we touch on issues that I think are relevant to Australia and internationally on anti-racist left strategy and principles, namely, how do we best beat the far right and combine anti-capitalism with anti-racism successfully? We also discuss how this relates to an analysis of the political history of the 20th century. How has the history of Nazism been portrayed, and how do these varying analyses lead to different political outlooks today? We also touch on how the question of Palestine figures in all of this. So I invited Leandros on the program on the back of the recent article that he's written for Jacobin, which of course I'm going to put up in the show notes, but is not compulsory to read before listening to this podcast. But I guess the immediate impetus for wanting to talk to Leandros was particularly the exaltation of Angela Merkel in the worldwide liberal media recently, well, in the last couple of years, but particularly intensifying as sort of the liberal establishment worldwide has suggested that she is the real leader of the free world now that Donald Trump, as President of the United States, no longer qualifies. So I wanted to get into exactly what sort of politics Angela Merkel represents. So without further ado, we'll be back for a short shout out at the end of the program, but let's get stuck into it. So Leandros, thanks very much for joining us on Mazel Tov Cocktail. To start off, would you just be able to introduce yourself?
Yes, I am a political scientist, originally from Cyprus. I lived for 15 years in Germany, where I did my studies and also my PhD. My studies were in social anthropology, and I decided to pursue a PhD in political science around 2010 on the subject of Die Linke's attitude, or its discussion, if you will, around the Israel-Palestine conflict, which in the German left is a very controversial subject. Besides that, I have been a member of Die Linke since it was founded, and was very active in the student branch of Die Linke at the university in Cologne, where I did my first studies. And currently I am an associate researcher at a Horizon 2020 program at the Technical University of Limassol in Cyprus. And I also have a second research that's about to start now on Cyprus as a place of exile and asylum for refugees from the Middle East. That's about it, actually.
Yeah, that sounds great. So, yeah, there's a number of issues in there that I want to talk to you about, and we'll definitely get more into talking about Die Linke, which is the sort of major left-wing party in German politics as we go through the interview. But one of the reasons that I wanted to, and we will also get into the discussion around Palestine, but one of the issues that, or the reason why I wanted to get you on the podcast was as someone from an anti-racist perspective in the German left, to talk particularly about the politics of the German Prime Minister Angela Merkel, especially because Merkel sort of, particularly in recent weeks, but over the last couple of years, has been fawned over by pro-EU liberals worldwide, firstly because of Germany's refugee policies, and now particularly she's seen as a counterweight to international right-wing populism. And this sentiment seems to have peaked recently with Merkel's visit to Washington, where the media sort of delighted in portraying Trump as an undiplomatic, unrefined idiot, whilst Merkel was praised because of her PhD and, you know, being very intelligent and as sort of a beacon of liberal democracy. And I was wondering, first, yeah, if you could comment about this media portrayal, and secondly, to fill us in on the actual nature of Merkel's politics and where she sits within the German political scene more generally.
First of all, I would say that this is a very inaccurate portrayal of Angela Merkel, and it's obviously based on ideology more than actual reality. And I would also add that it's based on wishful thinking. I mean, part of this trend of idolizing Merkel has also idolized George W. Bush. And actually, they're not really far off from one another. Angela Merkel, when she was heading the opposition to the Gerhard Schröder government around 2002-2003, you have to remember then during the election of 2002, Gerhard Schröder won because he conveniently used his opposition to the Iraq war in order to build up some kind of left-wing credential. And Angela Merkel was a steadfast supporter of George W. Bush back then, and was actually ridiculed as being something akin to Tony Blair. She even went to Washington to meet with Bush and proclaim her support for a so-called war on terror. But to fast forward to the present, there is actually one objective reality that sets Germany under Merkel aside from other European countries, and this is the reality of hundreds of thousands of refugees being actually in Germany. So this was easily attributed to some kind of generous decision by Angela Merkel to open the border, whereas in fact it was actually a very pragmatic decision on her behalf, because most of the refugees actually made it to Germany through the Balkan corridor before Merkel said or did anything. So she, of course, I mean, there are different assessments why she opted for impermanently, like limitedly, on this open border policy. There are some people who claim that it was basically one big scheme by German capital to let in very cheap, exploitable workforce to enter the German labor market and push the wages down. I think this is a very exaggerated view, because if that would be the case, then Germany would not stand behind the Fortress Europe policy, which has been in place for some years now, and whose key instigator was actually Wolfgang Schäuble. Remember him? He was the he's the German finance minister that brought Greece to its knees. Well, Schäuble used to be Germany's interior minister, and when he was presiding over the group of EU interior ministers, he was the architect of the so-called Fortress Europe policy, which basically amounts to this. So if people who come, let's say, from Afghanistan or Syria want to go to Germany, and the first country they enter is, let's say, Greece, which is mostly Greece or Italy, then they must seek asylum there. So it's a policy basically designed to keep people from the periphery of the world system, if you like, stranded on the periphery of the EU. And this was German actual policy until 2015. And I would say that she at that point, when there were hundreds of thousands of people making their way to Germany, and that Merkel took a very risky political gamble. And I think it paid off on the one hand, because her popularity was rising, and at some point she could present herself as a bastion of liberal values, you know, in the face of a right-wing populist onslaught. And so that was very successful. But on the other hand, as I said, it was a gamble. And beyond the media highlight, there was a slow but continuing backtracking on that decision, which the media have decided not to focus that much. So the CDU, the Christian Democrat Union, which is Merkel's party, which is the, you know, the main organization of German conservatism, has been occasionally, you know, running campaigns saying they will close the border, they will not accept more people in. Actually, people are not being accepted in that much. There is more vetting going on. So it's obviously not, I mean, we can discuss what, you know, the liberal ideal is, but, you know, I'm not a liberal, so I cannot tell you. I don't have an approximate answer of that. But I think this to come to this phenomenon of the cult around Merkel, I think it's pretty much a sign of desperation of a political project whose base is becoming narrower and narrower. So I don't think there's too much substance in it.
Yeah. I want to dig into, we discussed briefly the backlash to Germany's refugee policy in Germany and what the politics are behind it, and particularly about the AfD or the Alternative for Germany, this new far-right racist political force. Can you tell us a bit about that, the backlash, about Merkel's response, and about the place of the AfD, who they are, where they came from, how serious a threat they are?
Okay, so the AfD is currently the main political organizational expression of the German far-right, which in itself is something very... it's something unique in post-war German history, because the German far right, electorally speaking, was, with some exceptions, was mostly for the negligent. You know, they hovered around 1 to maybe 2% in national elections, and they usually had, after 1990, a stronger appeal in the deindustrialized parts of Eastern Germany. So the AfD is something of a taboo breaker, because should elections take place tomorrow, this would be the first time since 1945 that a German far-right party would enter the Bundestag. Of course, that doesn't mean that the far right, that there wasn't any far right potential in German society before then. The only difference is that it was fairly integrated within mainstream conservatism. So that was part of a sort of double track policy, you know, to in order to avoid the centrifugal tendencies of the Weimar Republic, which led to the rise of the Nazis, Christian democracy tried to, you know, verbally attract people with a far-right potential, but also keep them in and part of the legal, you know, parliamentary game. All this has sort of sprang out of control. But it didn't happen overnight. So one thing you have to remember about the IFD is that it didn't actually start out as a racist party. You know, it had racist undertones, but it actually began as right-wing, neoliberal, you know, Trumpite response, if you will, to the management of the Eurozone crisis by Angela Merkel. So these people were actually attacking the Eurozone crisis management from the right. You know, in a matter very reminiscent of the British Tories, saying things like, you know, why should the German taxpayer pay for those scroungers and those Greeks, those lazy Greeks, and, you know, the Spanish and all of them. And, you know, we should return to the Deutschmark, which was arguably the biggest sacrifice the German ruling class did for the European project. So this is actually... those are the origins of the IFD. The people who initiated the movement were, you know, neoliberal economics professors who were, socially speaking, liberal or, you know, mainstream. They weren't really racist or anything. But these people, in order to generate a social base, they played with themes commonly associated with the far right or the so-called identitarian right. So, for example, even before the IFD became an openly racist party, their youth sections would launch campaigns against feminism and ask young women to stand, like take selfies with a cardboard piece saying, "I am not a feminist because," you know, fill in the blanks. So there was already something going on there. And in the East, they strategically tried to anchor themselves on, you know, the old pre-existing far-right potential there. So in 2015, after the summer of 2015, with, you know, the Pegida protesters, the so-called patriotic Europeans against the Islamization of the Occident took place, there was a coup within the IFD, and Frauke Petri, which is which led the opposition to the social liberals within the party, she kicked them out, and she basically said that the IFD is now also the party of Pegida, which was an open embrace of you know, of the racism propagated by that formation. So from that moment on, you can see that, you know, the Euroscepticism that characterized most of the IFD's discourse slowly gets gradually replaced by, you know, opposition to America's refugee policies, fascination with regimes in Eastern Europe like Viktor Orban's Hungary, or Putin is also very very much an idol for the IFD because, you know, he runs a sovereign ethnic homogeneous capitalism, and this is actually what these people want. So the IFD has, you know, progressed to this point indirectly because of the Eurozone crisis and, you know, some discontent that it provoked among Germany's middle classes. And, you know, the fusion of this anti-elitist, sort of anti-elitist posturing with common Islamophobia, which was actually cultivated in Germany long before actually the IFD came to prominence. So this is actually like the cocktail which drives the IFD forward.
So yeah, now if we could tell us about the debates around the positions of Die Linke, the left party that you are a part of, about how to counter the AfD and criticize Merkel. So you've written a recent piece for Jacobin magazine, which I'll link to, and in this article you locate this debate as part of a wider discussion on the left, especially post-Brexit and post-Trump, to say this thing gets thrown around that the left is too PC and pro-identity politics, and ordinary or working-class people have legitimate grievances around questions of immigration, and we need to listen to them. So tell us about how these debates have played out in the German left, and why you're skeptical of that argument or that framing.
Yeah, well, I would zoom out first and say that in my personal opinion, one of the biggest difficulties that neoliberalism has given the left is its co-optation of things like anti-racism and anti-sexism, which were ideas firmly anchored in the left. And I think the one of the biggest challenges the left has in front of it in wider society is to reclaim those ideas back. And one of the ways in which those ideas were co-opted was via this ideology that Stathis Kouvelakis, a professor from Greece teaching at King's College in London, a former Syriza Central Committee member who left 2 years ago, described as left Europeanism. So left Europeanism as an ideology was actually the common reference point for most of Europe's, radical left parties, as you call them in political sociology, the parties left of mainstream social democracy. Whether it was the French Communist Party, the Rifondazione in Italy, Syriza in Greece, and of course the Linke in Germany. So this ideology of left Europeanism basically tries to, reclaim the idea of Europe and European unity, which as in itself sounds pretty progressive. I mean, who would want a war between France and Germany now? But in the framework of, reforming the EU institutions. So the main idea here is to say that, the EU as such is a very good idea, but it needs to be refounded on, on a social and democratic basis, which itself also a very noble idea. But the problem is that the very core of the EU's institution preclude any such reform project. And this was something that that Syriza had to face when it tried to challenge the austerity consensus. So, the whole weight of European institutions fell on Greece, eventually crushing any remains of what had been like a very radical project on behalf of Syriza. And this is what actually collapsed, I think, in July 2015 when Tsipras, he called a referendum tactically on his part, but for many people it was actually an urge towards popular mobilization. And then he made a 100-degree U-turn. So many people in the European left who looked up to Syriza and this idea of reforming the EU from within suddenly became disillusioned and started looking for other ways. And one of those responses was, to refound the European left on a left sovereignty basis, which means, exiting the euro, which in my opinion is a very good idea, but not as an end to itself, but as part of a wider anti-capitalist program. The one idea is exiting the euro and, taking power away from Brussels and back to, the national governments. And this is what actually Jean-Luc Mélenchon is now proposing in France, where he highlights, French sovereignty and identity and republicanism and all that, but from a left-wing kind of perspective. And this is what Sarah Wagenknecht and Oscar Lafontaine are actually trying to do in Germany, which is to say that, in order to have, classical social democratic policies again, you need to, you need to reclaim power from the EU and regain sovereignty, and that also includes limiting the flow of immigration, because you know, from a classical social democratic viewpoint, not a racist viewpoint, saying that, you know, mass immigration actually suppresses wages and all that. And this is one of the, I wouldn't say that it's a very coherent ideology, because a lot of people who support Wagenknecht among the Linke are actually they support her on the grounds that she's actually you know, she has been an exponent of the radical left wing of the party and very anti-establishment and all. But I don't know how to articulate it right now, but they. It's, you know, it's a response which actually leads to a dead end, because it's actually very reformist in the end. It comes with very radical pretensions, but in the end, it's all about, you know, regulating capitalism, which is a very classical social democratic theme. But this is like one of the responses, and Wagenknecht has been very prominent in articulating it. And the other ones are, of course, people like, you know, Gregor Gysi, who used to head Die Linke for most part of its existence, you know, that just want the whole coalition government, including Die Linke thing, going on again, you know, having a coalition with Social Democrats and the Greens, and, you know, not something very original, in my opinion. And of course, there's a third poll, which is in a minority, to which I would include myself in, which says that, you know, the answer lies in fusing, you know, anti-establishment discontent with anti-racism, and that, you know, saying that we need less immigration is not actually something against capital, but it's actually a concession to the whole logic of capital, which says that, you know, there is one big pie, and I will get 60 or 70% of it, and you and immigrants have to, you know, figure out the rest. So, you know, it leaves capital completely off the hook. And, you know, to finish off, I'm sorry for taking a bit longer in this answer, but to finish it off, you know, the diffuse feeling is that, you know, the left in general has been too politically correct, and, you know, we keep policing people and telling them what to think and how to speak. But, you know, in order to reach people, you have to come down to their level, you know, that and sort of like pick them up from there. But usually this amounts only to halfway, you know, just going down on their level and just staying there. And I think that's a problem, because it implicitly assumes that, you know, the working classes are racist because they feel threatened socioeconomically, and this is what drives them to racism. And when you have this kind of analysis saying that the liberal center proclaims anti-racism, it's like saying that, you know, the liberal center and capitalism as such are inherently anti-racist institutions. Well, you know, they're not.
Yeah. I think that connects to an interesting aspect of your article, which is the link between these contemporary politics and discussions on the left and historical analyses of what drove Nazism. And you suggest that Lafontaine, who is one of the major leaders of Die Linke, has adopted a common Western German social democratic economistic analysis of Nazism, which you find very inadequate. Tell us a bit about that.
Okay, so well, the current German state is actually the West German state that was founded in 1949 by the victorious Western Allies, and it was founded also in opposition to the East German state, which was more or less founded by the Soviet Union. So the national the raison d'état of the West German state was anti-communism. So which was framed in as anti-totalitarianism. So when mainstream politicians in West Germany in the 50s and 60s spoke about the rise of Hitler and the Nazis, they didn't see it as, you know, a response of the German ruling class to the rising threat of socialist revolution that threatened to engulf them, but rather as, you know, the rise of totalitarianism, which was provoked by, you know, the economic immiseration caused by the great you know, crisis of the 1930s. It was caused by demagogues and by the anarchic electoral system of the Weimar Republic, which had, I don't know, many, many parties in the Reichstag back then. So this was a very convenient ideology because the conservatives who had, you know, their members, their leading members at the time were all in the Nazi Party, could say that, you know, the problem wasn't fascism, but it was totalitarianism, and now the totalitarianism that we have against us is the Soviet Union and communism. So for them, it was a very convenient way of externalizing their own guilt towards the outer enemy, which was the Soviet Union, by more or less portraying fascism as some crazy infliction that came out of nowhere. The Social Democrats, on the other hand, they were very, very anti-communist because they blamed the KPD, the Communist Party in the 1930s, of being very sectarian towards them and thus not forming, you know, a popular front against Hitler. That's, of course, only half of the truth, because the other half of the truth is that the Social Democrats in the Weimar Republic actually, you know, endorsed all those right-wing measures before the rise of the Nazis to power, and, you know, effectively enabled them in their own way of coming to power. So when Social Democrats in West Germany spoke of that era, it was mostly in terms of, you know, economic deprivation leads to the growth of the extremes, which leads to also the rise of fascism. So, in order not to have the same experience, the consensus across all the German mainstream political spectrum in the after the Second World War was that you need stability, and stability entails political stability via a very high electoral margin to enter the Bundestag, which was it is at 5%, which is relatively high for an electoral system. So you can only have two or three parties in, and the most important of all, you need economic stability. So even Christian democracy recognized that, and you know, was all about Rhineland capitalism and corporatism and all of that. And social democracy said that, you know, in order to prevent all the disasters of the 20th century, you need stability, because if you don't have stability, if you have you know, deprivation, then you get, you know, the rise of the demagogues. And I think that in some way, LaFontaine adheres to that point of view. Maybe not 100%, but that's the way he was socialized. So I remember when I had an interview with him for Jacobin in 2 years ago, and I asked him about how he sees the rise of Islamophobia, and I was expecting something on the lines of, well, I asked him how does he explain that, you know, Islamophobia is becoming more rampant? And he said that, well, you know, when the people who are, you know, who feel relegated on the social scale, when they feel threatened, they kick down on those beneath them. So in order, more or less, in order not to have racism, you have to have economic prosperity, and that's all. But there wasn't any talk of racism being actively fostered from above. Or, you know, I don't think it's not because he doesn't recognize the possibility of that being possible, but I think it's only secondary, you know, and that's what I meant with an economistic perspective.
I think there's an interesting parallel between Wagenknecht's and LaFontaine's approach to combating the AfD. And sections of the Australian left's approach to dealing with our own far-right party. the One Nation Party.
Mm.
And that is particularly the trade union movement. That is that for them, they see that the answer to combating these far-right parties is to paint them as essentially neoliberal parties that just need to be exposed as anti-worker or pro-business to be defeated. Yeah, would you tell us why you think a bit more about, what a sort of maybe a more effective approach would be, and why that's quite inadequate.
Mm. Well, I think pointing out that, you know, parties like the IFD or the One Australia Party, you call it?
One Nation Party,
yeah. I think it's correct to say that these parties do not care about workers' rights. You know, it's we should not fall into the trap of, you know, the extreme center of you know, attacking these parties on account that, you know, they are being supported by the ignorant working masses against the enlightened elite. But that's only halfway. You know, the other one, the you need to go all the way and I think present just you have to emphasize that, you know, these parties have a certain dynamic also because of a racist dynamic within them. And this racist dynamic is explicable not by some, you know, inherent primitive fear among, you know, the working classes, but it's something which has been cultivated from above for at least 20 years now. And, you know, I think it's wrong not emphasizing the racism in these kind of parties because, you know, you cannot be pro-working class and ignore the whole question of racism. I think what should set the left apart from the liberal center is by having a more, I would say, instrumentalist approach to racism, you know, not just a moral one. We have to show that racism isn't just bad or a bad idea, which of course it is, but it's also bad for the interest of working people. You know, if you divide working class people along, you know, ethnic lines or, you know, people who are already in the country and people who want to get in the country, then this is something that in the long run weakens working class struggles because, you know, it presents capital as some kind of a fair arbitrator between different sections of the working class. And, you know, you're basically just asking the state and capital to play a fair game, which they're not going to play. So I think, empirically speaking, you can see that this kind of approach doesn't have the desired effect. To name one recent example, a week ago we had the local elections in the Saarland, which is the smallest German state, which is actually the state where Die Linke is headed by Oskar Lafontaine. And Oskar Lafontaine's Linke did not have a miserable result, but it didn't have exactly... you know, this strategy didn't pay off exactly. You know, there was a slight decrease in Die Linke's share of the vote. The big winner was actually Christian Social Democracy, because they presented themselves as a very, you know, social democratic force. So, you know, the left needs to develop its own independent profile. It cannot go around tactically mimicking, you know, the Greens or the Liberals or, you know, or speaking with a language that is, quote, acceptable, unquote, to, you know, to normal people, which usually means like ignoring the racism and not pointing it out, not calling it out, etc.
So you've written another really interesting piece for Jacobin a couple of years ago that I'll also link to, and it's called The German Left's Palestine Problem.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm wondering how the question of Palestine and questions of anti-Semitism and Islamophobia are linked to these current debates. So, yeah, what is the place of Palestine within these debates over racism and anti-racism in German politics?
Yeah, it's a very complex issue. I will try to be as brief as possible on it. There are two aspects to the Palestine question in Germany. The first aspect is the conflict as such, which is not the aspect that it's that is much discussed in public discourse. The other aspect is Israel and Palestine as, you know, symbolic issues, through which anti-Semitism among the left allegedly is expressed. And I think there is a connection between this debate, the Islamophobia debate, and the rise of the far right. I'm just gonna try to do a little rewind here, just to maybe explain the historical origins of this this debate. German society before the late 1970s was actually a very apolitical society, and one that was characterized by amnesia about the past. So, of course, people knew that something bad had happened to the Jews and that the Nazis were to blame. But the common assumption back then was that this was just, you know, part of the... This was only done by the hardcore of the Nazi party. So the whole role of, you know, collaborators and enablers was actually not discussed because it brought actually shame. And one of the ways of overcoming this this sort of guilt complex was through a very ardent support of Israel, you know, by, you know, by mainstream conservatism in the 50s and 60s, and support for Israel, demonization of the Arabs and the Palestinians, and all that. But that was something which was related to guilt due to the past. Now, I don't think that this is the issue anymore, because what you had from the late 70s onwards were all these discussions, those public discussions that took place in West Germany for the first time around, you know, the Holocaust and who was actually to blame and who enabled it, etc., etc. So you had this very big debate in the 1980s, the so-called the Historikerstreit, the historians debate, in which, Ernst Nolte, a revisionist historian, he basically put forth the argument that the Holocaust was a preventive measure on the part of the Nazis in order to avert the danger of Soviet atrocities, which became evident after the 1917 revolution. And when Nolte was saying that, he was actually moving within the mainstream discourse of totalitarianism, equating, you know, fascism with communism, etc. And Jürgen Habermas, the heir, the most known heir to the Frankfurt School, he rightly condemned Nolte's revisionism, but then he said that, you know, he put forth the argument that any contextualization of the Holocaust is inadmissible, more or less. And by saying this, he was actually reproducing the tenets of American-based Holocaust literature that appeared in the 1980s. You know, not Holocaust research of the likes like Raoul Hilberg, but, you know, research in the sense, like literature in the sense that, you know, the only legitimate response to anti-Semitism is Zionism. So from that moment on, well, not from that moment on exactly, but Habermas also talked about, you know, the German state as a post-national state. And he coined the phrase Verfassungspatriotismus, like constitutional patriotism, which more or less gradually became the ideology of the reunified German state. So the reunified German state after 1990 can do all the things that the West German state could not do because of historical constraints. It can wage war again, whether it is in the Balkans or in Afghanistan or elsewhere in the Middle East. It can make militarism hip again. It can also be very racist towards Muslims, but it will always be, in the eyes of its supporters, it will always be free of the accusation of revisionism because it supports Israel. So it's a bit, I don't know if I make it clear, but it's a sort of symbolic issue. Like you have all this surveys and data on anti-Semitism in Germany, and they all show that, the overwhelming majority of anti-Semitic incidents, around 80%, are committed by white ethnic Germans. They're not committed by the left. They're not committed by radical Islamists, but they're committed by ethnic Germans. So by having media overtly focused on anti-Semitism on from Muslims or the left or something, this amounts to basically externalizing the stigma of anti-Semitism, projecting it on others. So this indirectly, the fight against anti-Semitism, which actually means the fight against criticism of Israel in this case, is being transformed into this element of German pride. So it's a very complex situation. It's sort of like a new national identity arising, excluding others, on account, by claiming itself to be free of all the historical baggage of the past, and all that. So yes, in this case, Palestine is of course affected as an issue because, I mean, you have this phenomenon in other European countries, but that criticism of Israel or anti-Zionism is equated with anti-Semitism. It's something which is much more, it's a much more common accusation in Germany than it is in the UK or France, for example, or I don't know, Australia for that matter. So, yeah, sorry, I was talking too long.
No, that's great. No, there's a lot of really interesting stuff there. I think that we'll come about to the end of the interview. Is there any sort of parting thoughts that you want to leave with us?
Parting thoughts. Well, I can only end with what is my in general assessment of the situation we find ourselves in as the left today, not just in Germany but also worldwide. I think those are very difficult and challenging times, and it appears that this crisis that we're going through is a prolonged crisis of hegemony within the capitalist system. And well, I believe we're getting to a point where the answers on the left will have to become more precise and more radical because the standard assumption on much of the left after 1990 was that we need to be the vocal opposition against the system in order to help shaping it in the end in a more humane and social manner. And I think that recent events have disproven that this is possible. So I don't know what the answer is, and I don't have any recipes, but I can only emphasize what I wrote in my Jacobin article on Sarah Wagenknecht, namely that the answer lies in bringing together the various anti-racist and anti-sexist struggles with a solid class perspective. Which does not have any place for shortcuts or any illusions in the power of buzzwords like populism or I don't know.
That's great. All right. Well, thanks very much for being with us on the podcast again, Leandros. Yeah, we definitely hope to have you on the show again down the track, perhaps to update us about goings on in Germany and in Europe more broadly. That would be great.
Thank you very much for having me.
Great.
Great. So thanks very much again to Leandros Fisher for that very interesting discussion. And we certainly hope to have Leandros on the program again sometime soon. The shout out for today is to another piece from Jacobin. Yesterday was April 19th, the anniversary of the Warsaw Ghetto Uprising. And there's a very good piece by Marcus Barnett in Jacobin called Remembering the Warsaw Ghetto. It highlights the politics of the young people involved in the uprising, and it's a very readable account of the uprising and suggests that we can and should read it as a Jewish internationalist part of a worldwide struggle against fascism and capitalism. So highly recommended. That's it, and we'll see you next time on Mazel Tov Cocktail. Music in this episode came from the Eastern Watershed Klezmer Quartet.